Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're here again to really get into the details on important topics. Today, we're going to talk about the radial head fractures chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette. Now, just a reminder, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Radial head fractures. They're common, surprisingly so. And you know, while they might seem straightforward, just an elbow thing, they're often this like critical red flag. What looks like just one injury can actually signal much bigger problems, problems affecting the wrist too, which isn't always obvious. So understanding all that right from the start, it's vital for good outcomes.
That's a really important perspective, a red flag. Okay, so let's jump right in then. Thinking about these radial head fractures, what's the key anatomy? What makes the radial head itself so critical here?
Well, the radial head is it's really central to how the elbow works. Its uniqueness is in this dual articulation. Think of it like as a cup that fits perfectly on two different things. One side, the concave part, it cradles the convex capitellum. That's the end of the humerus, your upper arm bone. That lets it glide, you know, when you bend and straighten your elbow.
Okay, so it glides.
Right. And at the same time, it pivots against the ulna, the other forearm bone. That pivoting motion, that's what lets you twist your forearm, like turning a key or using a screwdriver. Supination and pronation. So it's doing these two things, gliding translation and pivoting rotation. That's what gives the elbow such such a great range of motion.
Gliding and pivoting. Got it. And its position is interesting too, right? The sources, the head and neck, are technically in the proximal forearm, sort of just below the main joint, not right in it. And just near that, there's the annular ligament. How does that fit into the picture?
Oh, the annular ligament is absolutely key. It's like a strong band, a collar almost, that wraps around the radial head and holds it snug against the ulna. That secure connection is what allows the radius to rotate smoothly around the ulna while still letting it do that gliding movement against the capitellum. Without it, you wouldn't have the stability for either of those movements. It'd be, well, unstable.
Right, stability. And you mentioned it connecting to the ulna, but also linking somehow down to the carpus, the wrist bones. How does an injury here at the elbow cause problems way down at the wrist? That feels a bit disconnected.
Yeah, it does seem that way, but it's all about the kinetic chain. The radial head isn't just for the elbow. It's kind of the cornerstone for the whole forearm.
Yeah.
It transmits force from your hand up the radius to the humerus. So if that radial head is badly damaged or if it has to be removed, the whole radius bone can actually shift upwards, migrate proximally. This puts weird abnormal stress on the ulna up near the elbow because it's not designed for that load. And it also totally messes up the mechanics at the wrist joint. Unexpected wrist pain, often chronic. It often traces back to that radial head issue.
Wow. Okay. So a problem up top really can cause trouble way down below. And the way these fractures happen, it's not usually a direct blow to the elbow itself.
Exactly. It's usually, perhaps counterintuitively, from a fall onto an outstretched hand. Foosh injury, we call it. The force travels up the arm, driving the radius proximally, sort of jamming it into the capitellum at the elbow. That axial load is what causes the break.
Right, the fooshing. Okay, so we have the anatomy, the mechanics. How does this look when a patient actually comes in? What's the typical story, the presentation?
Well, the history is usually that fall on the outstretched hand, like we said. Or sometimes it's higher energy, maybe an actual elbow dislocation. Symptoms, pain is the big one, obviously. And you'll often feel an effusion, some swelling right over the elbow joint because of bleeding inside. Their movement will be limited, both bending the elbow and twisting the forearm. And if you press right over the radial head, it'll be tender. Passively rotating their forearm, that's usually quite painful.
That effusion, the swelling, that's blood from the fracture leaking into the joint, right? And I've heard aspiration can really help getting that fluid out. How does that work?
Yes, exactly. It's a hemarthrosis blood in the joint. Aspirating it, pulling that blood out, maybe with some local anesthetic, it can be incredibly helpful. First, it relieves the pressure, which gives immediate pain relief. And second, by reducing that pain and pressure, the patient can often start moving their elbow gently much sooner. And that early motion is so, so critical for preventing stiffness later on. It really speeds things up.
That's a great clinical tip. So beyond the story and the exam, how do we confirm it? What's the objective evidence look like? Imaging, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. Radiographs are essential. You need standard AP front to back and lateral side views. And crucially, you need them of both the elbow and the wrist. That wrist view is vital. You have to look closely at the distal radial ulnar joint, the DRUJ, on that lateral film. Make sure it's not dislocated. Because if you have a radial head fracture and a DRUJ dislocation, that's a specific nasty injury called an Essex-Lopresti fracture, missing that wrist part.
Yeah.
Big problems down the line.
Essex-Lopresti. Okay, definitely one to watch for. What if the standard x-rays aren't totally clear? Are there other tricks, other signs? I think I read about a fat pad sign.
Yes, the positive fat pad sign. It's a really useful, though indirect, sign on the lateral elbow x-ray. Normally, fat pads around the joint are kind of hidden. But if there's fluid in the joint, usually blood from the fracture, it pushes those fat pads out, makes them visible. So seeing that fat pad sign strongly suggests something's going on inside the joint, even if you can't quite see the fracture line itself. And if the standard views are iffy, sometimes oblique views, sort of angling the x-ray with the forearm in neutral rotation, can help visualize that radial head capitellum joint better.
We have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com. Edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Bayet. Just a reminder, this deep dive is great, but before you take a test, certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Okay, so we know how to spot it. Who tends to get these fractures? Are there differences, say, between men and women? Well, the overall numbers are pretty even, roughly 1-to-1, male to female. But the story behind the fracture often differs. Men tend to be younger when they get these, and it's often from higher energy stuff, falls from a height, sports, car accidents, that sort of thing. Women, on the other hand, often have lower energy injuries. Sometimes it might hint at, you know, underlying bone fragility. Now, it's not considered a classic osteoporosis fracture, but what's interesting is that if a middle-aged woman comes in with one, it's probably wise to at least think about assessing her bone density as part of the bigger picture.
Right. Not directly osteoporosis related, but maybe a clue. Good point. And thinking about the bigger picture, when we diagnose this, it's not just about the radial head fracture, is it? It's about what else might be injured. What are those additional diagnoses we need to hunt for?
Exactly. Seeing a radial head fracture should immediately make you think, what else is going on? It's a red flag for associated injuries, both at the elbow and the wrist. That's why we x-ray both joints, right? You absolutely have to look for other fractures like the capitellum or the distal radius down by the wrist. You need to rule out that DRUJ dislocation we mentioned. And ligament injuries too, especially the medial collateral ligament, the MCL. If that's torn, the elbow can become unstable in a valgus direction. Even things like a tricep tendon rupture or a full elbow dislocation can happen alongside it. It's rarely just the radial head.
Wow, quite a list. And there's one specific combination you hear about, the terrible triad. What exactly is that and why the dramatic name?
Ah, yes, the terrible triad. It definitely earns its name. It's a specific, very unstable pattern. You got the radial head fracture plus an MCL rupture plus a fracture of the coronoid process of the ulna. That combination just makes the elbow incredibly unstable. It's tough to treat, and the prognosis can be guarded, hence terrible. Recognizing it is critical.
Okay, so a complex picture. Once we have the diagnosis and we know about any associated injuries, how do we classify these radial head fractures, and how does that guide what we actually do for the patient?
The Mason classification is really the key here. It helps us decide on treatment. So a Mason type 1 is non-displaced. The pieces haven't moved much. And importantly, there's no mechanical block to rotating the forearm. For these, we usually go non-operative. A sling for comfort, maybe aspirate that blood from the joint like we talked about, possibly with some anesthetic for pain relief. But the main thing is early motion, getting them moving within, say, 24 to 72 hours, as soon as they can tolerate it. Maybe a short-term splint, but really mobilization is key.
So type 1 is mostly about getting it moving. What about type 2? Is that where surgery starts to come in?
Generally, yes. Mason type 2 fractures have some displacement, maybe mild angulation or impaction or a bit of depression. But again, the key is still no mechanical block to rotation. These often benefit from surgical fixation, ORIF open reduction, and internal fixation. We want to put the pieces back together accurately. How we fix it depends on the pattern. Maybe just some small screws if it's only part of the joint surface, or maybe a small plate and screws if the fracture involves the radial neck.
Okay, and then type 3 must be worse. When do you actually think about taking the radial head out and replacing it?
Exactly. Mason type 3 is where you have significant displacement, angulation, impaction, or depression. Or there is a mechanical block to motion. The joint just won't turn smoothly. In most type 3 cases, the pieces are just too smashed up, too comminuted to reliably fix. So the standard treatment becomes radial head excision, taking the broken head out and replacing it with a prosthesis, an artificial radial head. And then there's Mason type 4. That's defined as any radial head fracture that happens with an elbow dislocation. For type 4, the very first step, urgently, in the ER, is to reduce the dislocation, put the elbow back in joint. That basically turns it into either a type 2 or a type 3 fracture situation. Then you proceed based on that, fix it if you can, or IF, or replace the head if it's too fragmented, arthroplasty. Reducing that dislocation quickly is paramount.
That classification system really lays out the logic. So after the treatment, whether it's surgery or not, what's the recovery like? What are the main goals and potential bumps in the road?
Well, the biggest enemy, honestly, is stiffness. Elbows just love to get stiff, especially after injury and immobilization. That's why early active motion is stressed so much. We're fighting that stiffness right from the start. If someone keeps having a lot of pain or swelling or inflammation that doesn't seem right, you have to think, did we miss something? Is there another injury? Often, a structured, supervised therapy program is really beneficial to maximize their range of motion and overall function.
And you mentioned earlier how this elbow injury can cause chronic wrist pain. Let's revisit that. What are the specific reasons someone might have wrist pain long after their radial head fracture seems healed?
Yeah, that chronic wrist pain is definitely something to keep on the radar. It could be from an associated injury that wasn't initially recognized or fully addressed, like damage to the DRUJ itself, or the interosseous ligament connecting the forearm bones, or that triangular fibrocartilage complex, the TFCC, in the wrist. Sometimes, unfortunately, complications can happen during surgery. Injury to the posterior interosseous nerve, the PIN, can occur, leading to problems with wrist and finger extension like a wrist drop. And then there's that proximal radial migration we talked about, especially if the radial head was removed, and particularly if it was part of an unstable injury like an Essex Lopresti that wasn't fully stabilized. The whole forearm structure can gradually deform.
Lots of potential pitfalls there. And the source also mentions other things like malunion, healing crooked, non-union, not healing, avascular necrosis, bone death, heterotopic bone, extra bone forming, complex regional pain syndrome, and even arthritis later on. Definitely a complex recovery sometimes. Okay, to really hammer home the key concepts, let's quickly review five essential terms related to radial head fractures.
Sounds good. These five really encapsulate the main points. First, the radial head itself. Remember its unique anatomy, articulating with both the humerus and the ulna, critical for both elbow and forearm motion, and surprisingly linked to wrist stability. It's more than just a piece of the elbow. Second, the terrible triad. Not just any combination, but specifically radial head fracture, MCL rupture, and coronoid fracture. Recognizing this is vital because it screams instability and signals a much tougher management challenge. Third, the positive fat pad sign on X-ray. It's that subtle clue, the pushed out fat, that signals fluid, usually blood, inside the joint. A strong hint of an intra-articular injury, even if the fracture isn't obvious. Fourth, Essex Lopresti fracture. This specific pattern, radial head fracture plus DRUJ dislocation plus likely interosseous membrane disruption, is critical to identify because of the high risk of late problems like proximal radial migration and chronic wrist issues if missed or undertreated. And fifth, radial head replacement or arthroplasty. This is the surgical solution, using a prosthesis. For those severe comminuted fractures, like Mason type 3 is some type 4s, where fixing the original bone just isn't feasible. It aims to restore stability and function.
That's a great recap. We've really gone deep today on radial head fractures anatomy, how they happen, how patients present, the imaging, associated injuries like that terrible triad and Essex Lopresti, the Mason classification, treatment options from slings to replacements, and potential complications. Clearly, a lot more complex than it might first appear. We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. Orthopedia by Bernstein, Penny, and Viatt. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.
You know, what's really fascinating here, and maybe a final thought, is how often what looks like one single injury, like this radial head fracture, is actually the tip of the iceberg. It forces you to look wider, to consider the whole interconnected system. It's a great reminder, I think, that in medicine, real understanding often comes not just from spotting the obvious problem, but from connecting all the dots, seeing the whole picture for that individual patient.